So outside of frictional charging, you also have fractal emission. So this is the breaking of particles. You'll see this if you ever seen high-speed video and somebody shoots a pane of glass, you'll sometimes see a flash of light. That's fractal emission. Obviously, with a volcano, it's happening on a much larger scale, so you'll have rock and parts of rock breaking, and you'll get electrical emissions there. Then you have more traditional convective charge separation. That tends to be more with part of the cloud that that's a density disparity through the cloud, where you have lighter parts and heavier parts of the cloud. And that's sort of similar to water and ice interactions within the cloud. And then, of course, there's ionization because you got a lot of extreme heat and gas, and that can ionize the air, and that contributes to conductivity and charge buildup within the plume itself, too. So a lot of different mechanics going on that create lightning within volcanoes. And Mount St. Helens had a ton of lightning with the initial eruption. VA3VWX. Okay, Biscuit saying hello. I'm going to finish off here shortly. I'm just going to get into the radio stuff in a section shortly. So there was one thing that was interesting. There's a great article on the internet. It's from Springer Nature, and it basically discusses the storytelling of the trees that were affected by the various pyroclastic flows and the blasts that came off of the mountain. And there are areas where trees are standing and other areas where they're not. And basically, in summary, as you get further away, obviously, from the source of the pyroclastic flow, the pressure force falls off. So it's you go from having trees knocked down to trees sort of stripped of their branches and to trees that are just lightly damaged. But one of the interesting takeaways from that is that in some places, these pyroclastic flows, they would skip over areas. So that doesn't mean that the areas escape, because the pyroclastic flows are very hot. But what happened was you'd get basically... As the cloud jumped over certain areas, the trees and everything underneath the pyroclastic cloud, well, they all became superheated and starved of oxygen, so the trees and other things, they would stand and not be blown over, but they would turn to charcoal, whereas all the trees around them, let's say, behind the hill that this pyroclastic flow jumped over, those trees would get knocked down. So, and this is unfortunately where some of the people, cooked to death. They were taking refuge, and they may not have been blown away, but as they were surrounded by pyroclastic flows, they obviously didn't survive. VA3VWX. Okay, and the effects on radio. So obviously, if you have an electrically charged ash cloud, that's not good. You get static interference. You also have signal attenuation and absorption, just because volcanic ash is composed of all these tiny jagged particles of pulverized rock and volcanic glass, and those can absorb and they can also scatter depending on what the frequency is. So they're very bad for radio waves, especially if you want to send a signal through. If you're trying to get a signal from point A to point B, an ash cloud isn't great. It might be good if you're going to do some sort of bounce DX or something, but in terms of getting a signal from point A to point B through that ash cloud, they're a real problem. And then you also have the conductivity of the ash cloud, a dry cloud versus a wet cloud. So while volcanic ash is generally dry, and that makes it an electrical insulator, sometimes volcanic ash can retain moisture, and it can actually get wet, and then it becomes electrically conductive. So you have it go from an insulator to a conductor, and that can create issues with short circuits, grounding, and that can also that'll have negative effects on transmission lines, electrical components, et cetera, et cetera. And you can also get a flashover where if you have wet volcanic ash accumulating on high voltage equipment, all of a sudden your porcelain insulator is no longer an insulator. It's now connected, and then you'll have a flashover where you'll have an arc basically across the insulator. And of course, you have the, while not a radio effect, it's highly abrasive, right? So it can damage equipment and everything else. And then the last part of it, which is an indirect effect, is, and we saw this with Mount St. Helens, is that the telephone system becomes overloaded because people try and use it to communicate and get messages across, and there's simply too much traffic for the system to handle. So, what role did amateur radio operators play? Well, it was a watershed moment, as we've discussed, for U.S. Geological history, and it was one of the most destructive volcanic eruptions to occur, especially in the continental U.S. and globally as well. And what ended up happening was that amateur radio, it played an important role. There were a number of agencies involved, the Amateur Radio Emergency Service, ARES, the Radio Amateur Civil Emergency Service, RACES. Those were the two primary groups that were active, and they had a large mobilization of support efforts that took place. So in the months leading up to the big eruption, Mount St. Helens, obviously, there was unrest, and people recognized this. And what ended up happening was that amateur radio operators were called out to assist with watching the mountain and, relaying any developments that they had. Let me cycle it. So, obviously, while the U.S. Geological Survey had its own people out there, they were looking for support from others. So, supporting those officials that were actually monitoring the mountain, you had all these amateur radio operators that were affiliated with RACES, ARES. And what they were doing was they played a critical role in providing ground relative observations, and those observations went to the Washington Department of Emergency Services. And one of those volunteers was known as Jerry Martin, and he was a 64-year-old Navy veteran with training in shortwave radio and obviously an active radio amateur with RACES. And he knew the value of amateur radio, especially because cell service wasn't a thing at the time, or at least, not as we see it today. So Martin volunteered for the Washington Department of Emergency Services, WDES, and through his involvement with ARES/RACES, he was able to get himself into a strategic position to provide real-time observations from his vantage point near the volcano. So Jerry Martin, he positioned his motorhome up on a ridge about 2 miles north of the main geologist observation post on May 17, 1980, and that was just the day before the major eruption. So he was sitting there watching the volcano, and then what ended up happening was he sat there, and the volcano basically erupted. And at 8:32 that morning, and his last messages were actually recorded by another set of ham radio operators, and they go like this: 8:32 a.m. Oh, now we've got an eruption down here. Now we got a big slide coming off. The whole west side, northwest side, is sliding down. 8:33, he continues to say, "Oh boy, we got it, boys. The whole northwest section." And north section is blowing up. It's coming up over the ridge towards me. I'm gonna back out of here. 8:34 a.m. Gentlemen, the camper and the car sitting over to the south of me is covered. It's gonna hit me too. 8:34, a little later. We can't get out of here. And that was his final transmission. And while ham radio operator, David A. Johnson, he was a 30-year-old volcanologist with the USGS, and he was stationed at an observation post on Johnson Ridge, known as Coldwater 2, and he was 6 miles to the north of the summit of Mount St. Helens, and he was actually a principal scientist on the USGS monitoring team. So his role was also critical in observing and reporting the volcano's activity. So when the volcano erupted at 8:32 a.m., he felt the 5.1 earthquake. He went out and he watched the events unfold. So what ended up happening for him, unfortunately, was he keyed up his radio and he said, "Vancouver, Vancouver, this is it." But the USGS office in Vancouver, Washington, never did receive the message. Instead, it was received by an amateur radio operator and relayed to them. And it's suppose at that point in time that the ash cloud coming off of the volcano, they were using VHF at that time, the equipment, they were in the higher section of the VHF band, they were around 160 megahertz. The other equipment they were using was 400 something on megahertz for the sensing equipment. But nonetheless, the volcanic eruption blocked the signal, and that's why They had numerous issues getting the VHF signal back to the USGS office in Vancouver, Washington. Victor Alpha 3, Victor Whiskey X-ray. So unfortunately, those two lost their lives. However, as alluded to before, there were amateur radio operators played a very significant role. What had happened with the eruption, and this is a testament to the helicopter and other pilots of the time, the entire landscape around the volcano changed in an instant, and in the 1980s you were using printed reference maps. So of course when the helicopters and others got up in the air to search for survivors and victims, etc., there was a forestry crew not too far away that had to be rescued, and two of them had very severe burns. All the reference points on the map did not exist anymore. Lodges, trees, roads, and even the lakes had changed, right? The boundaries of the lakes had changed, and their physical position had moved. So it was very hard for pilots in the air to look down and make, you know, have a good reference of where they were. So there was a ton of traffic that was relayed back and forth between different agencies, including amateur radio operators. And there are a few accounts of amateur radio operators who had been observers, relaying that they'd come across survivors that had made it out of the trees to them covered in ash and debris, including a couple different cameramen for TV stations in the area that had come across amateur radio operators and had been able to relay their message, use the amateur radio operators to help relay messages that they were alive and then eventually get escorted out. And it's estimated that in excess of 10,000 messages were passed within the first 2 weeks of the explosion by amateur radio operators. And they're immediately in the area, but they're about the volcano, and they were official messages going back and forth in some capacity about Mount St. Helens, going to different destinations. So amateur radio played a significant role in this. And outside of amateur radio, there were a few others. Robert Landsberg, he was a photographer. He was killed by the pyroclastic flow. But his body was found, and the film roll that he had on his body was developed, and they had some direct photographic evidence of the blast as it approached, which was important images. Reed Blackburn, he was a photojournalist. He was killed. Unfortunately, his film burnt up. Gary Rosenquist, he was the amateur photographer that took a series of 22 images of the sequence of the actual explosion. It's the only known photography showing the actual eruption, explosion, landslide, etc. The only thing he's missing is he has a nice photo of the volcano in the morning during sunrise, and then he misses the initial start of the collapse of the north face of the volcano. But everything else from Gary is fantastic. And there's a whole list of other people over here that are there. And one of the big names over there was Harry R. Truman. He was an 84-year-old innkeeper. His wife passed away, and he had a lodge on Spirit Lake, and he makes all sorts of appearances in various newscasts prior to the eruption. And he said that he wasn't leaving, and if he thought he had to leave during the eruption, he'd get in his speedboat to make it across. Unfortunately, the blast that likely killed him was moving at, in excess of 300 miles an hour, so I don't think a speedboat could have kept up. He was likely killed either instantly or very quickly, and his body and none of the remains of his cabin were ever found, so that's it. And the loggers I mentioned were Barry Providence, Jerry Martin, and Bruce Brown. They survived, but they had severe burns. So it was a huge eruption. Okay, I've taken up enough of the science nut. I've given Ken a good 1 hour break. This is Victor Alpha 3, Victor Whiskey X-ray. Any comments, questions, eyewitness accounts, come on in. This is VA3VWX.
Yeah, this is November 6, Delta Tango.
November 6, Delta Tango. Come on in, let us know what messages you relay, how you relayed the messages, and what your interactions were. Come on in.
well, so I was at Castle Rock, activated the disaster center. It was up at the Catholic Church there in town. At that time, my call was November 7, Alpha Oscar Tango. And initially, I heard the traffic on the 2-meter radio and switched over. We were using, we were keeping 5-2 Simplex open. For they were using that to try to raise the individuals, Hams and others up on the hill, and just trying to find them. So they were using the 5-2 and 4-6 Simplex, I believe. And then the repeaters, actually, fortunately, in Calhoun County as well as down in Portland, I think all the repeaters are working. And so we were communicating through there in 6DT on the move. So we were checking in people coming into the disaster center. A lot of people were being brought in by neighbors and things who were at pickup trucks and jeeps and sit through the mess. So where I was located was about a mile south of where the Toodle River flows into the Calhoun River, and that was a mess. There was a large log jam that had hit I-5 bridges. And they were concerned about losing the big steel bridge at Toodle River, I-5, so they closed it for a while until they get inspected. And then but most of the traffic was literally names being passed into the disaster center, Calhoun County County Offices Disaster Center, and simply just saying, okay, yeah, we've got... you know, we've got this family here, we got these people here, and just trying to make sure that everybody knew essentially who was missing and who was safe. Message traffic was very short. It was mainly giving names and just saying, hey, they're okay. And sometimes the message included, oh, yeah, we're staying at the neighbor's house or something like this, but then we were also passing messages of missing. So I think the first message traffic I passed through on around 4 in the afternoon, which is when all the information started collecting, I got a list of about 150 names. It seemed like I had pages of names that I was writing down, and we were trying to match up. And by 12 hours later, we had got it down to a list of about 45, 50 people. Didn't pass a lot of traffic as to individual information other than simply letting authorities know that this family were okay, but they were staying at this place and or staying at these people. And you know, the one thing was difficult, we did have a lot of phone service that was out, but we also had some that was working, so which was good. At least where people had phones, you know, we could get a number later on and say, hey, loved ones are here, and all of that. And then late at night, so I opened mine up. I opened mine up around 3:34 in the afternoon, but I was monitoring my radio from about 9:30, 10 o'clock that morning. So I was, you know, listening to the calls, looking for the missing and picking up on it, and just checking in and getting my assignment to go up and work the disaster center in Castle Rock. But it was very busy the first 24 hours, then it slowed up. You know, we had a list of missing, and then probably about 5 o'clock the next morning, they asked us to get isolated, saying we have some information where we have some actual missing and confirmed deceased. And they passed that information along because I did have, sometimes I'd have local sheriff's officers and other police coming in and just wanting to know what information I had. It was a long 3 days. Anyway, I opened up Sunday afternoon and I got my first nap Wednesday morning about 3 a.m. I took a couple hours sleep. Had a cot next to the radio in case they wanted to call me. And after Wednesday, it got more of just people coming to the center, and grinding the list down from the missing to their, we know where they're at and recovered, and assisting law enforcement and others just with some traffic information. Also, there were some issues about, as you mentioned earlier, about roads being out. There was a main road along the Tuba River, which was basically gone, although there was points where people could come off the hill, drive a half a mile to a mile, and get someplace, get back up into the hills. Logging roads were pretty much open, but there was a lot of people that stuck because they couldn't leave where they were at, which was a little difficult, but, a couple of helicopters went in, and they were just stopping at places where they could see people, get names, and finding out they need help or anything. And so we got that information as well. So we were passing a lot of little bits of information. This is N6DT for ID.
Yeah, November 6th, Delta Tango, Victor Alpha 3, Victor Whiskey X-ray. Thanks for that. It's fascinating to hear your first-hand account. And it was a different era. Ham radio played a really significant role at the time. Cellular networks weren't there, and it's always just amazing to see how integrated everything could be, especially when radio communications at times would have been a challenge due to the eruption itself. And then, of course, you had all these people scattered across in different places. But it's just amazing. You know, I watched a bunch of YouTube videos, and I also, too, the other thing was amateur radio operators, also likely being scanner enthusiasts, were monitoring other parts of the band and listening to USGS and other stations, and then relaying that information to others if the original message never made it out. So it's absolutely fascinating to hear your firsthand account. If you don't mind, I'm just going to pass it over to Ken, and I'll let Ken take over net control. And if he has any more questions for you, which I'm sure he does, I'll let him fire them off. Victor Alpha 3, Victor Whiskey X-ray, over to Ken, VA3KEX for neck control.
VHV is Ken. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for the presentation. Great presentation. So it was very interesting. I've got a couple of things that I'd like to add. Nothing much, nothing that detracts from your presentation, but just a few things I thought folks might find interesting, too, about this. Before I do, any additional stations, come on in. Any comments, come on in. All right. Thank you, Tom. Thank you so much. As I said, great presentation. I enjoyed it. In regards to the volcano, too, part of the quiz when I was talking about the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, to give a bit of a comparison here, when the volcano went off, it went off with what's estimated between 24 and 26 megaton force. And that's the equivalent of about 1,600 Hiroshima bombs, or about 1,142 Nagasaki bombs. Hiroshima was around 15,000 tons of explosive, and the Nagasaki is around 21,000 tons. So it shows you the immense amount of power one of these volcanoes has. In a comparison to some of the other eruptions over time, like the Yellowstone caldera, which is over 600,000 years ago, this was like minuscule compared to that. So it gives you an idea how much power is released on these. Just drop. Another thing you mentioned too about lightning produced by volcanoes. another aspect of how it's produced there too, I thought I'd just add this just for an FYI for everyone, is radioactive charging. And you don't hear too much about that with volcanic eruptions, but radioactive charging. So there's within the plume, there's a lot of material that's coming up from the ground, a lot of it's gas that's radioactive, and this gives off decay particles. Any of the decay particles are charged. You've got alpha particles, beta particles, you have gamma rays coming from this as well. So the alpha particles are a positive charge, beta a negative charge. You get a separation of charges there, and it leads to a flash of lightning. Gamma rays, although they don't have a charge, but they are ionizing. So they help with the ionizing process, what's going on within this plume. Just drop it. The other thing, too, which is interesting, oftentimes, prior to a volcano going off, the pre-eruption, and it often gives off gases. And one of the hints around a volcano that there's an eruption about to take place, or at least you should maybe be taking notice of something happening, is birds. Birds will be dying. They're particularly susceptible to carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide, the two big ones there. So birds, you often find birds, as with Mount St. Helens, prior to the eruption, people were seeing numerous birds that were dead from the gases. And the gases in the ash in particular, pardon me, is rather corrosive because a lot of it contains things like calcium sulfide, hydrogen chloride, and sulfur dioxide, and even hydrofluoric acid. So even the ash is very corrosive. So if you breathe it in, it's problematic for your lungs. The glass from it can cause silicosis, which damages the lungs. It causes scarring, fibrosis in the lungs, which makes it difficult for people to breathe. The last thing, and this is interesting, not just for volcanoes, but even for the search for life elsewhere in the universe, is that volcanoes, when they go off, oftentimes there's certain bacteria that are living around volcanoes. When they go off, they find this bacteria. You wouldn't think you'd be able to find anything living anywhere near volcanoes shortly after they go off. But there are a number of bacteria that survive. Just dropping Phyllolava venerus, as scientifically is referred to as Epsilon proteobacteria. And it oxidizes sulfur from the hydrothermal vents and from the heat from the volcano. So they survive. They're extremophiles. They can survive. And there's also things like actinobacteria, beta proteobacteria, and Neferi bacteria. However, with Mount St. Helens, just dropping, there's a brand new bacteria, a whole new bacteria that was found. It was unknown to science at the time, and it was an evolutionary bacteria that happened over a short period of time. It was a chemosynthetic bacteria, and no one knows. No one actually knows where this came from, meaning that they don't know what it actually evolved from. It had to have come from some bacteria near at hand, but they don't know what it evolved from, but it did. So why I bring this up is if bacteria here on Earth can survive in these extreme environments here on Earth, like around volcanoes, and volcanoes can help produce new bacteria, you have to wonder on some of these planets, even within our solar system, some of the moons within our solar system, whether there's bacteria brewing there. And that's all I've got to ask. Anyone have any comments or questions for Tom? Come on in. Okay, thank you, Tom, again for that tonight. It was enjoyable and very educational. I enjoyed it immensely. Pele's hair, that's another one. When lava, it'll form bubbles. Gas helps the lava form bubbles. It'll explode and forms these really fine strands of volcanic glass. And breathing that in is absolutely horrendous for the lungs. You get scarring. That can even produce fibrosis in the lungs. Horrible stuff to breathe in. That can cause some huge problems as far as destroying lung tissue, and some people end up going to respiratory failure because of it. And that's it. And if anyone has any further comments about St. Helens, you'd like to pass along to Tom, come on in. And then we'll move on with a couple of things here for tonight.
This is PA6TBO. Just checking in as a loyal listener, and I just want to express that the presentation of Mount St. Helens by Tom was excellent, fascinating, and that goes with the first-hand account. Brilliant. And that, back to the net.
CBO, EA3KX. Yeah, wasn't it, though, Ted? It was very, very good. And even the first-hand account there of a person who had experienced it was good to listen to. All right. Well, then we'll push on with a few topics here tonight before we tie the ribbon. Maybe I've got about a half hour left. I'm exhausted here today. I had a few things I was doing here today, or one main thing I was doing here today, and it's a little tired tonight, but I think I've got time for a few here. There was a new study. We're talking about bacteria here, and I thought this ties in with this tonight, too. There's a new study that has shown that there's never before seen bacteria, some new bacteria that was seen on a NASA robot that was sent to Mars. It was seen prior to sending to Mars, but it was never before seen bacteria that was on one of their craft that was getting ready to launch. Any stations out there, if you'd like to join us, I'd check in. Come on in.
KK6RQ, Clear Lake, Iowa.
Connected. And one more time slowly with your call sign.
Sorry, Kilo 6, Romeo, Quebec, Bob in Clear Lake, Iowa.
I got you that time round. Thanks for coming in. This new study, just before I move into this here, something I've got to mention too, ties in with Tom's presentation. Now, this book is a bit dated. It goes back to 1969, but there's still a lot of really relevant things in it about volcanism, tectonic plate dynamics, things like this. It's called The Changing Earth. It's a virus. And 1969, I've had this book for a very long time. It's still in print. If you're interested, give it a look. You might be able to find a copy of it online. Still a lot of really good information. Although it's a little bit dated, there's still a lot of great information in there. There's a NASA clean room. It was actually used to quarantine a Mars lander before it was launched. And it had never before seen extremophile bacteria inside it. This was 17 years ago. And microbes were reported to be capable of living in a vacuum of space. It doesn't appear that the spacecraft was contaminated on Mars. They really don't know for sure, but they don't think it was. And the Phoenix Mars lander, it touched down on the Martian surface. This was back in 2008, May 25th. And it collected data for about 161 days before it suddenly went offline. And before its departure to Mars, it spent several days inside a clean room at the Payload Hazardous Service facility at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Stopping. The purpose of the clean room is to quarantine and decontaminate spacecraft before launch, and even after they return to Earth, so that environmental contamination doesn't occur. Either way, they're either going to another planet like Mars or coming back here. And the rooms are sterilized, pressurized, and continually vacuumed, and fitted with special filters to keep out 99.97% of all airborne particles. And people coming and going, they have to shower when entering and leaving, and they have to wear these special suits, almost like hazmat suits. Researchers, they took a look at samples collected from the Phoenix lander, lander's clean room, before and after the craft was quarantined, and they found DNA. They found DNA from 26 novel species of bacteria, novel being a new species of bacteria. This was written up May 12th in the journal Microbiome. And for the most part, these newly discovered organisms have characteristics that made them resistant to harsh environments like radiation, pressure, and extreme temperatures. And a few have been shown signs of DNA repair and even detoxification of harmful molecules. And some of them even showed improved metabolism and even being able to survive living in the vacuum of space. Stopping again. Newly discovered species, they made up about a quarter of all the bacteria identified in the room sample. So the takeaway from all of this, aside from the fact that clean rooms are not 100% effective, is that it gives scientists an idea of what extraterrestrial microbes might look like and how to protect Earth from them. And not only that, just to when they're searching for these on exoplanets, it gives them an idea what areas to be looking for. So these bacteria, they can survive. Which also brings up an interesting question about panspermia, where organisms can traverse space and take up residence on another planet, like these microbiomes, and eventually evolve into something. This is EHVKS, Ken here, and this is the Science and TechNet for this Saturday evening, transmitting here from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Any stations that could join us, if you have a comment, come on in. And then another one about bacteria, too. This is about China. They had a space station, and it was found to have an unknown strain of bacteria on board there as well. The Tiangong space station. Much like the NASA discovery, this is a new never before seen microbe, and this was found on the space station, the Chinese space station, and it was given the scientific name of Nihalea Qigong genesis, and it's a variant of one that lives in the soil on Earth that has the ability to cause sepsis. So it's a variant of it. So it's a new virus or a new bacterium. And some new sleuthing has revealed that the bacteria isn't just one of a kind, but has acquired some adaptations that could be beneficial to other space missions. The research was published March 3rd, so it's going back a little bit in the journal, International Journal of Systematic Evolutionary Microbiology. The novel strain, it was extracted from samples collected in 2003 by the crew of the Shenzhou 15 mission. And after returning to Earth, analysis showed that the bacteria was related to Nihalea feculens, which is a bacteria that's found in soil, sewage, and food. And this one can also result in sepsis, and particularly in immunocompromised people. But the new strain had developed a few adaptations to survive in the extreme conditions of space, like the genes that code to respond to oxidative stress. It was able to repair the bacteria from radiation damage, and also to break down the gelatin to extract carbon and nitrogen. So it had a few adaptations there that were beneficial for it in space. As it is right now, it's not known if this new strain is dangerous to humans, but it's new, and they're still examining and analyzing this to see exactly what implications it can have for us. Just dropping again. This gives pause to space missions and coming back to Earth, and they're now being a little bit more careful about the bacteria on board these space missions and how quickly they evolve into something different as it's going back to Earth. And this is EH3KX, Ken here, and if you'd like to join us for the Science and Tech Net, come on in, transmitting from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And the next one here is about reanalysis of some data. Indicates that Venus might still be geologically active. For a long time it was assumed Venus was basically geologically dead. But now, after looking at some new data, some old data, just reanalyzing it, they're finding out Venus is most likely still geologically active. If you'd like to join us, come on in.
Test 1, 2, 3.
And that station there, come on back in. And this one here, it's kind of raising some eyebrows because they're looking at this some old data, reanalyzing it, and they're coming out of the conclusion that Venus might still be very much geologically active, and that has a lot of implications. So ages now, scientists, they've been scratching their heads wondering why Venus became uninhabitable, considering that it has similar evolution to Earth and it was bombarded by almost equal amounts of water early on. After going over more than 30 years of pre-existing data, scientists have come to the conclusion that Venus is still pushing hot material to the surface. This was written up May 14th, not that long ago, May 14th in the journal Science Advances. And there appears to be a growing body of evidence that Venus shares similar internal dynamics with Earth, even though it doesn't have Earth-type plate tectonics. And the new evidence comes from dozens of big ring-shaped areas on Venus's surface, and they're called the coronae. And these form from plumes of hot rock rising from deep in the mantle, and this pushes the crust upward. And once the surface cools, it collapses into a circular shape. And 75 of these have been resolved, and 52 sit above the mantle plumes. Many of these coronae are in places where the planet's crust is thin and the heat below is pretty high. So studies have determined that when the crust is about 40 miles, about 65 kilometers thick, it has the tendency to break off and melt. This melting can serve two purposes. One, it helps regulate the planet's surface structure and could also help recycle water and other stuff back into the planet's interior. So this could influence volcanic activity and even the atmosphere. And the other thing with this too, it helps shift around surface material, which has which then means that the surface of the planet is still evolving. And NASA, be a NASA mission that's heading there. That's going to be mapping the planet's surface at a resolution 2 to 4 times higher than previous missions. NASA's Earth's mission. And there's a Da Vinci. This is another mission that's planned for 2029. And this is going to look at Venus's atmosphere and surface chemistry. Earlier on, they think they may have found some chemicals in the atmosphere that may be signs of life, phosphine as one of them. And the European Space Agency mission is set for 2030, and it's going to provide high-resolution surface mapping. So once these missions get underway, we'll most definitely, at that point, have a better handle on exactly what is going on geologically with Venus. Drop it. And our habitable zone here on Earth, now we were, let's say, 7,500,000 kilometers further towards the sun. We'd end up having a huge greenhouse, runaway greenhouse effect here. And at about 90% or 0.09 astronomical units. An astronomical unit is about 93 million miles. That's the distance the Earth is away from the sun. So if we're within that distance, about 90% of that distance, very basic life would survive on Earth. If there was around 0.995 astronomical units, life would likely still survive in some areas, but the temperature on the planet would be starting to heat up. A lot of life would find it almost impossible to survive. So Venus is even closer than that. So it's well outside the habitable zone of our planet here. So what happened earlier on? Just dropping. Venus may have evolved much like Earth, may have had oceans on it at one point, may have had even rudimentary life on there, even before the Earth. One big reason for that is very, very early on, the sun was dimmer than it is now, which would mean the habitable zone would be around where Venus is. And that would have given Venus an opportunity to develop into a planet that was likely habitable, but things changed. Things changed over time. They're still trying to figure out what was going on there. I mean, the sun has brightened since then. It was dimmer back then. It has brightened since then. And that would have played a big impact on Venus's future. So we still don't know for sure. This is VH3KX, Ken here, Science and Tech Man. If you'd like to join us, come on in. You have a comment, come on in, and then I'm going to move on to another one. And I think I've got time for two more for tonight, then we'll tie the ribbons on the net. We'll pick up again next week. This first one here, and then the next one. This one here is a study that came out about birds and why they haven't gotten as big, because they are descendants of dinosaurs, why they haven't gotten as big as some of the dinosaurs. And then right after that, about something I talked about on another net, about maybe two nets back, maybe three nets back, probably three nets back now, five nets back. It was about a planet. It was an exoplanet, K2-18b, where they thought they found chemical signals of life. They're still not completely sure, but they may have jumped the gun on this. Wayne of VH3FMB, we were talking about this earlier today at an outing. I thought I'd include this in here tonight. So for birds, during the past 66 million years, and that's after the Chicxulub impactor, which that's the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs down the Yucatan Peninsula, which is now the Yucatan Peninsula. And during the past 66 million years, on different continents and islands all over the world, the avian dinosaurs have reached these impressive sizes. And they even become apex predators in some of these ancient habitats. There were 10-foot tall elephant birds. They roamed across the Madagascar until 1,000 years ago. There were sharp-beaked terror birds of prehistoric South Africa. and they were efficient carnivores for tens of millions of years. And these huge birds, it almost seemed like a return to Mesozoic days of these giant feathery dinosaurs, which raises the question of whether these avians, these birds could have ever reached the size of a Tyrannosaurus Rex. In fact, Tyrannosaurus Rex, from some of the research that's come through, suggests now that it was probably covered in a very light layer of feathers. So the repeated evolution of these huge birds is part of the dinosaurian legacy. These big birds were the only dinosaurs to have survived the asteroid-triggered mass extinction at the end of the Cretaceous period. So avians like these birds, particularly one was called the Titanus. It was a towering carnivore bird that was the only terror bird to live in North America between 1.8 and 5 million years ago. And that kind of underscores that the huge dinosaurs were not regulated to the time of, like, say, Stegosaurus and Triceratops, but they extended themselves much longer after that. So the conditions that allowed birds to evolve to large size over and over again have varied from kind of case to case, you want to call it that. However, the process has left a question. If birds possess the traits that open the possibility of the really giant, multi-ton, non-avian dinosaurs, why haven't we seen a bird the size of the T-Rex? A study, a 2023 study, there's an ornithologist, Raquel Ponte of Portuguese University of Porto, and some of her colleagues looked at the influence of the what they refer to as island woolen bird. And a hypothesis, it states that on a relatively isolated island, island environment, large species often become smaller, and smaller species become larger. Dropping. The phenomena, it's often attributed to the lack of large, hungry predators like big cats, dogs. It allows the island species to evolve in different ways than if predators were influencing island ecology on their own. So birds can get big in the absence of predators eating eggs, chicks, and even flightless adult birds that can't simply fly off and escape. So the very mola species of ancient New Zealand, like enormous elephant, and even enormous elephant birds of Madagascar, and even the recently extinct dodo, are all examples of what can happen when birds settle in an island. So when a species colonizes a new environment, there are no predators or competitors, as well as new resources and food availability. The species is free to evolve toward optimal sizes, so they can get big. They can get big, and their shapes can change. One common trend in that island-dwelling birds not only tend to become larger than their mainland counterparts, but also evolve longer legs and rounder wings. And both traits are connected to spending more time on the ground and a shift away from migrating by flying. And only possible because of the absence of predators. And these predators are basically their rages to pick off the birds and spend much of their time just foraging on these birds. The important thing is that big birds, they tend to evolve in habitats with plenty of ecological possibility. Isolation on an island without large carnivores can open a lot of possibilities for birds, but so can living on larger land masses where resources are pretty plentiful and predators aren't around very much. They tend to be either rare or just very few. And big fossil birds lived along these huge forests around 50 million years ago. Mammal carnivores were small and they didn't have a big influence on the prehistoric landscape. Like, they were still scurrying under rocks, etc., just to stay safe. And these big terror birds of South America benefited from this. The continent was a giant island between 2.7 million and 66 million years ago, where the biggest mammalian predators ranged from weasel size to about as big as a leopard, and maybe around 100 pounds. In South America, without a lot of competition for large mammal carnivores, terror birds were able to evolve into a variety of predatory niches, including apex predators. So they're allowed to evolve into some of these huge predators. So the carnivorous birds, like mammals, they evolved into a huge array of sizes, they undoubtedly had different prey preferences, but they were allowed to evolve. So whether on islands today or larger continents during prehistory, big birds evolved wherever such flightless giants could kind of peck out, no pun intended here, but could peck out a niche for themselves. On ancient North America, which was more connected to Eurasia during the past 66 million years, large birds lived between 45 million and 55 million years ago, and a pattern suggests that in habitats vacated by large hungry predators, the easiest thing for some birds to do was to get big and not fly. In each of these cases, it appears that birds grew to large sizes relatively quickly during times that predatory mammals and birds of prey were either rare or just absent. Despite how often big birds have evolved, however, none have reached the height or even the masses of some of the non-avian dinosaurs that were living between 66 million years and 322 million years ago. So for flying birds, the lack of airplane-sized birds like the monsters in the 1957 creature feature, what was that, the giant claw, explained by some of the constraints around flight. And flying is a pretty energy-intensive behavior. It needs a lot more muscle and energy and muscle power than the bigger an organism gets, to the point that a flying creature can only become so massive before it's grounded. But there's a different story for these flightless birds, what allows them to get big. And there's at least two factors that allowed dinosaurs, including birds, to evolve to a wide range of sizes. Paleontologists have suggested that air sacs that are in around the respiratory systems of many dinosaurs surrounded and invaded their bones, which allowed their skeleton to be lighter without sacrificing strength. And the addition of helping animals breathe more efficiently. And also this type of bone structure they had, it allowed their bones to become much lighter. And if you look at a bone, even a bird bone, or if you look at a chicken bone, you look inside a chicken bone, a lot of lattice work in there. If you compare that to a mammalian bone, you'll see something different. A mammalian bone tends to be much more dense towards the center. So that was an evolutionary thing. Egg laying, too, has been cited as a critical factor in giganticism. Laying eggs, rather than gestating offspring inside, freed dinosaurs from having to carry bigger and bigger babies for long term, as elephants and other animals, large animals, do. Birds retain both these traits from their dinosaur ancestors, yet they've never equaled even the largest extinct relatives in size. Even though air sacs and eggs are an important factor to giant dinosaur size, these biological quirks remove barriers rather than require bodies to get bigger. In the post-Cretaceous world, birds have likely never experienced sufficient evolutionary pressure to be as tall or as massive as a T-Rex. Maybe predatory birds like terror birds could have grown larger. Being bigger would have allowed them to catch, kill, and consume a broader array of prey. But right now there's no evolutionary interaction that would take place to boost the size of birds right now. They really don't need it. There was another study, the 2023 study, and it suggests that terror birds were stomping on and kicking prey smaller than themselves rather than going after large animals like giant sloths and maybe even some of the large armadillos that were living in prehistoric times, for example, in South America. And that may have limited how large they actually became. So the end things here, based on some recent findings in South America, paleontologists know that terror birds that are at least 10% larger than the giant 10-foot-tall skeleton lived on the continent. It's unlikely that terror birds got much larger, given that available prey were mostly small. The largest terror birds